This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello and welcome to the Ask an Astronomer segment. My name's Mike. Across from me, we have an astronomer.
Hello. My name's Ian MacDonald, and I'm going to be answering your questions.
Yeah, that's good. Show runs in quite a logical way. We'll start with a question from me, and Ian will answer it. So, first of all, to get us off on such a happy note, do we have any idea when the sun will explode?
Well, I do like a bit of existential dread. The short answer is the sun won't explode, but in about 8 billion years it will run out of fuel. And many people, when they think of stars dying, think they end up exploding violently in a supernova. But only a few percent of stars actually do this, the stars that start out with more than about 8 times the mass of the sun. Most stars have much more quiet deaths. And it's quite a complex process. It's the fate of smaller stars like our Sun and the planets that orbit it that I actually explore here at Jodrell Bank. We know that most of the Sun's future will look very much similar to what it does now. It's a main sequence star, which means it burns hydrogen to helium in the centre. And it's not a normal burning reaction like we see on Earth. It's not like setting fire to something. It's nuclear burning. And that's a bit like having a controlled atomic bomb, a bit bigger than the Earth, going off in the middle of the Sun. The Sun will keep this nuclear reaction going until all the hydrogen in its middle is used up. Currently the Sun's fuel tank's about half full, which means it's got another 6 to 7 billion years left. We can't say exactly because we don't know precisely how the mixing processes in the Sun will change during that time. Once the Sun runs out of its core fuel, it switches to its reserve tank and starts burning hydrogen outside its centre. That's bad news for us because it makes a star puff up into a red giant. And it'll be a little over 2 times brighter than it is now, and about 2 times bigger, which means the Earth gets quite roasty-toasty. It'll be hot enough to boggle the oceans, leaving our planet as a superheated greenhouse like Venus. However, plate tectonics will also have stopped on Earth, so the oceans might just have sunk into the Earth's crust. But anyway, it's probably not somewhere that you want to live. And Mars might be looking like a better home for us. But not for long. Because over the next few 100 million years, while the Sun's a red giant branch star, it'll get a lot brighter. It'll reach about 2,000 times its current brightness, slightly more, and it'll swell up to about 200 times its current size. It'll have swallowed Mercury and Venus whole, and it'll have expanded out to nearly the orbit of the Earth. Swallowing these little planets doesn't have very much effect on the Sun. They spiral into the Sun just keeps going. By this time, the Earth's surface will easily be hot enough to melt rock, and many rocks will have started vaporizing and forming clouds over our lava planet. So the Earth won't exactly be somewhere you'd want to go on holiday. Now, from this point on, we can't predict exactly what will happen, because the Earth sits in quite a special location. Whether the Earth will survive or not depends on exactly how big the Sun gets as a red giant star, and this depends on how much of the Sun is lost through the solar wind between now and then. It could be as much as a fifth of the Sun's mass, it could be as little as maybe a 20th. We don't have good enough measurements of red giant branch stars to be certain, and it's likely it'll become about as big as Earth's orbit, in which case our planet will be tidally sucked into the Sun and destroyed. Every recognisable trace of humanity's existence on Earth will be dispersed into the atmosphere of the Sun. And in the last part of the red giant stage, it's the horizontal branch and the asymptotic giant branch, the pressure and temperature inside the Sun gets high enough to start burning helium into carbon. It'll take the Sun only about 100 million years to use up its supply of helium, but the Sun will still be fusing hydrogen, making fresh helium. And when the helium burning catches up with the hydrogen burning, the Sun's nuclear engine cuts out in a spectacular fashion, with huge nuclear explosions happening inside the star called thermal pulses. These thermal pulses are millions of times brighter than the Sun is now, and that isn't big enough to destroy the Sun, but they're big enough to start turning the whole star inside out, and that brings a lot of the atoms from these nuclear explosions up to the surface of the Sun. This is one of the ways that stars seed the galaxy with life-bearing elements, and if it hadn't happened to previous generations of stars, ones that existed before the Sun, we wouldn't be here today. Because as this is happening, the surface of the Sun is becoming unstable too. The Sun's surface currently bubbles away quite happily. It's a bit like a pan of simmering water. But when the Sun expands in its death throes, the gravity on the surface goes down, and this is like lifting the lid off a pressure cooker. The Sun will start bubbling violently, throwing its atmosphere off into space. The core of the Sun will light up this expanding cloud of solar atmosphere, probably forming a very faint planetary nebula. Meanwhile, the atoms that made up the Earth, the very atoms that make up our bodies today, will form stardust around the dying Sun and use the light of the dying star to sail off into the cosmos. So 4.5 billion years ago, we were stardust, and in a little under 8 billion years into the future, to stardust we'll return. I've been looking at this cosmic recycling process for the last 13 years. seeing how stars die, how their ashes get formed into new stars. And it's an important process for understanding why we have the ingredients needed for life on Earth today. It's also useful for understanding whether those conditions exist on other planets throughout the universe. And I hope that in a few years' time we can give you a much more accurate picture of what the eventual fate of the Sun and the Earth will be than what I've given you today.
That was the fate of the Sun, and it's not going to explode. So, to stick with this theme, our next question for you is, will the Sun ever go cold then?
Well, yes, it will, but it'll take a very, very long time. When the Sun dies, it shakes off its atmosphere, and its core will still be thousands of times brighter than the Sun is now. Eventually, that'll reach a blistering temperature of about 100,000 degrees centigrade. But because it's run out of fuel, it isn't making more energy, so it'll start to cool and shrink down, becoming a white dwarf. Now, white dwarfs are the ghosts of stars. Not much interesting happens on them. Occasionally rocks might crash land on them, but otherwise they just sit there and cool down, a bit like a cosmic potato coming out of the oven. But because it's several thousand billion 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 times bigger than the potato, and several million times hotter in the middle, it'll take a lot longer to reach room temperature. A few tens of millions after it becomes a white dwarf, the Sun will be about the same brightness as it is now. But it will still be about 40,000 degrees on the surface, and that'll be enough for it to be glowing blue. If the Earth does survive this long, it'll now be a much more comfortable temperature, but the surface will be scorched down to the mantle, there'll be no recognisable atmosphere, and the Sun will be baking our planet in UV radiation, so it's not somewhere we could survive again. After a billion years, the Sun will reach about 10,000 degrees and glow white hot, and about 3 billion years afterwards, the Sun will cool to its present day temperature. It'll shine a feeble yellow, and if you were standing in Earth's orbit, the Sun would appear about 100 times smaller than it does today, just a spot, so it would be about as bright as today's moon. The oldest white dwarfs that we know of in the universe are about 12 billion years old, and they glow a sort of orange colour, since they're about 3,500 degrees centigrade. But white dwarfs will keep cooling as the universe ages, and in about 20 billion years from now, the Sun will be glowing a dull red, looking a bit like Mars in the sky. And after about 30 billion years' time, it will cool enough to fade from view. Now, it will still be hotter than an oven on the surface, but to our eyes it will have stopped glowing and turned from a white dwarf into a black dwarf. After about 100 billion years, the Sun will reach room temperature, and what it would look like at this point is anyone's guess. We don't really understand how matter behaves under these conditions. However, it's probably not a place that you'd want to stand on, because the gravity would be about 200,000 times what it is on Earth today. There might be an atmosphere, a few meters thick, but that would quickly give way to a sea of liquid and then solid hydrogen. The gravity would be enough to squish you into people pate, at which point your atoms would be gradually dispersed into the cold heart of the Sun. The Sun will keep getting colder and colder, until it reaches the same temperature as the space around it. No one knows exactly what temperature that'll be, because strange things happen to the very atoms that make up the universe over extremely long periods of time. But after hundreds of trillions of years, all the stars in the universe will have gone out like this, and be left a cold, dark, and dead place.
Such beautiful, hopeful views of humanity there from Professor Ian. So, to continue our theme of disappointing and depressing answers to questions, we're going to ask how long humanity would survive without the Sun.
How long we could survive without the Sun depends on how technologically advanced we are at the time, and exactly how the Sun was lost in the first place. It's not exactly the sort of thing that gets stuck behind the server. In the vast dead future we just foretold, we can envisage humanity eking out an existence with all sorts of scientific methods. You could make artificial stars, you could live in nuclear-powered spacecraft, you could do a whole host of things. But if we suddenly lost the Sun today, we might be in a bit more trouble. We rely on the Sun for almost all the energy we receive, either directly through solar power, or indirectly through the plant life and fossil fuels that we eat and use. So we can predict a good amount of doom and gloom ahead. Now, as far as we know, stars don't just pop out of existence. So even though we could imagine what would happen if the Sun did spontaneously vanish, we're not going to do that here. Instead, we're going to come up with a rare but realistic scenario about what would happen if the Sun lost us. Now, the most likely reason for this to happen is that the Sun passes close to another star, and the gravity of that star pulls the planets out of their orbits. Now, for a star like the Sun, this is a very rare event. It hasn't happened in the last 4.5 billion years. It's unlikely to happen in the next 4.5 trillion years. We'll have to assume that the passing star wasn't so close as to start frying us, but just close enough to temporarily overpower the Sun's gravity and start us moving away from the Sun, let's say at 40 kilometers a second. 40 kilometres a second is about as fast as we could reasonably expect to go and survive the encounter. A large brown dwarf coming in from the galactic halo might be able to do this. Most stellar encounters would just nudge the orbits of the planets a bit. So getting this kind of catastrophic ejection event means setting up the encounter just right. Even for a passing star as faint and dim as a brown dwarf, we'd still have a few years warning of its passage, and that gives us enough time to start preparing. We'd also make this happen in the Northern Hemisphere midsummer, to give the world's biggest cities the best chance of survival. If you were to do this kind of thing just by turning off the sun, people would be dead in probably a few weeks. But with this question, we've got slightly longer. Now, you'll see a lot of answers to this kind of question out on the internet, and some of them are quite accurate. Some of them, not so much. What's quite clear, though, is that most of us wouldn't survive very long, even with time to prepare. We'd need to take a great deal of time and effort to make sure that a select few people would survive. The minimum number of people you need to keep the human race going is probably about 150, or about the size of humanity's largest base in Antarctica. So this is starting to sound feasible. The first thing that would become important is the cold and the dark. In our scenario, global temperatures would start to drop by about 3 degrees centigrade every day. So after a week, half the continents would be covered by ice, and fuel shortages would start affecting people, mainly in the southern hemisphere. People will start to die from the cold, either because they can't find the fuel or because they don't have enough insulation in their houses. And after about 2 weeks, the northern hemisphere's summer will have turned to winter, and most plants will have started dying, and most of the land will be frostbound. Now, the sea here saves a lot of people because it can convect up more heat from deep water, and also holds a lot of heat. So the sea will cool more slowly than the land, and bring warmth to the land that surrounds it. This temperature differential will change the wind and weather patterns, and that will probably bring strong wintry storms off the sea, dumping snow far inland as the air cools. And shortages of supplies will start affecting most people, leading to riots and looting, general anarchy. Within a few weeks, temperatures of minus 40 degrees will be common in most tropical countries. Well-prepared coastal communities might survive a few months, and in the UK we'd be among the last survivors, thanks to the residual warmth of the sea around us, quite well-insulated houses, and a fair few coastal fishing communities that are generally well-stocked with fuels. But after a year or so, even the sea around us would freeze, and our last sources of food would start to die off. Without a society to depend on, our survivors will have to generate their own fuel and food. Food will have to be grown indoors, we'll need a couple of acres of heated, lit greenhouses, and any fuel sources that operate on the surface aren't going to work well in the extreme cold. Our selected bunch of survivors doesn't include enough specialists to keep a nuclear power station going for long, or the equipment needed to keep mining fossil fuels through the ice. And cold and lack of fuel will generally reduce us to being cavemen. And actually, caves wouldn't be a bad place for humanity to base their future. Rock holds its temperature pretty well, and deep in a cave the temperature would actually only drop very slowly, about the rate of a degree per year. Survivors could live in these deep caves using geothermal energy to provide light to grow plants, and siphoning water from underground aquifers. And in this way, small ecosystems could be kept alive, deep underground. It would have to be a graded move, with each generation moving down a few metres into the earth as the surface layers cooled. But areas with strong geothermal potential, like Iceland, could be among the best places for humanity to seek shelter in. From an engineering perspective, however, the greatest challenge probably comes a few years after our ejection from the solar system. Once temperature in Antarctica drops below about minus 210 degrees Celsius, the atmosphere starts to freeze out. Strong winds would start up, dragging all the atmosphere into a new ice cap on the South Pole, made mostly of nitrogen and oxygen. Our survivor's cave would have to be pressurized to keep the atmosphere in, and that atmosphere might slowly leak out through the porous rocks, so a method of extracting a breathable atmosphere from rocks would have to be found. Now, the heat at the center of the Earth is generated mainly by radioactive decay, so it'd be like having our own natural nuclear reactor. Slowly, the temperature at the surface would probably decrease to about 20 to 30 degrees above absolute zero. If these challenges I've described can be met, though, there's no reason for humanity not to survive a few kilometres underground for billions of years. In fact, the biggest challenges we'd have to face might not be so much physical as psychological and political. And it's likely that specialised life forms would survive even if we didn't. Life forms like those around oceanic hydrothermal vents and microbes deep in the rocks may be relatively unaffected. A similar method of survival has been proposed for life on Mars. Life can't survive on the surface of Mars today, but if life arose early in Mars's history, it's just possible that it might be clinging to existence deep underground. And similar methods have been proposed for interstellar travel, not by ejecting Earth from the solar system, but in spaceships made out of hollowed-out asteroids. This could be one realistic way in which humans could eventually explore deep space.
Well, there we go. We actually had a positive note there. Humanity can survive and perhaps explore deep space. We'll finish off then with a question slightly related to this. We've talked about the Earth getting much colder and the problems that causes, but what is the coldest planet?
Well, strangely enough, I'm trying to find it. When I'm not looking at dying stars, that is. As we saw in our last question, a good way to get a planet really cold is to get it as far away from a star as possible. And in our own solar system, Neptune's the farthest planet from the Sun. Its temperature is about 60 Kelvin, or about minus 210 degrees Celsius, and it's actually one of the coldest planets we know of. We do know of other cold planets going around other stars, and some of them are probably about the same temperature as Neptune, but we don't know of any planets that are colder. To find colder planets, we have to look back at the scenario that we've just looked at, planets that have been ejected from the Hurst stars. This should happen to a few percent of planets, usually either at the very start or the very end of their star's life. And those planets will now be floating among the stars. In fact, there may be more free-floating planets in our galaxy than there are stars. Billions and billions of them. And the smallest of those planets will be the coldest, because they cool down faster. Something the size of Mercury might only be 10 or 20 degrees above absolute zero. So something like minus 260 degrees Celsius. These are probably the coldest kinds of planets in the universe. They're really difficult to find, because they're completely black. They've got no starlight to reflect. And we have to wait for them to pass in front of a star to see them. When they do, light from that star is bent around the planet, making that background star appear slightly brighter, maybe only for a few hours. Using this method, we can find these free-floating planets that are quite happily chugging through space on their own. We've found a handful of these kind of planets so far, and they're the coldest planets we know of to date. But I'll be looking for some more of them as you listen to this.
Good luck to you in your search. That was Ask an Astronomer with me, Mike, and Ian.